Okay, good morning, we'll get started. Thanks everybody for coming. I know you're really going to enjoy this. It's our second annual Supreme Court year-end review and a preview of what's coming. And, you know, just because they knew we were having this seminar, yesterday the Supreme Court took another bankruptcy case, so we'll hear about that. Very exciting and current we've got for you today. And our speakers are Pete Lane and Tom Schreiner. So thanks to them and thanks to you for coming. Next month we have our annual ethics. We don't have Jack anymore, but we have Mark Metz and Olivier Ryer are going to come and head us up our discussion of ethics, so you'll get your ethics credit. And I just confirmed we will have cookies from Paula. So please come next month. It's going to be December 9th. That's the second Tuesday. Cookies and ethics. Well, you just can't beat that. Now, we've had a lot of discussion on the listserv about credit reports and reaffirmations. Judge McGarrity is going to speak to us in January, January 13th, credit reports and scores after bankruptcy, myths, legends, and maybe a little truth. So I know you folks that are interested in that issue are going to want to come back in January. So, again, thanks for coming today, and come on back next month for ethics and cookies, and January for credit reports. Pete and Tom.
Morning.
Morning. Well, it's been a pretty active session for the court. They've made four decisions and granted cert in three cases, the most recent of which, as the judge said, was yesterday, which Tom is going to talk about at the end of our presentation. The first case we're going to talk about is Executive Benefits versus Arkansas, which was a much awaited decision by the court, the first post-Stern pronouncement on its scope and what it meant. And as far as I'm concerned, the case is as important for what it didn't decide as it is for what it did decide. Just a brief review of the facts. Pre-petition, the debtor transferred commissions to a longtime employee into a separate entity called Executive Benefits, then filed Chapter 7. The trustee filed a state fraudulent conveyance action and an action under 548, although Executive Benefits hadn't filed a proof of claim. The defendant asked that the reference be withdrawn and demanded a jury trial, but asked the court to stay a decision on that motion pending a ruling on the trustee's summary judgment motion. And the bankruptcy court granted the trustee's summary judgment motion. That was affirmed by the district court, who actually did a de novo review, which will be important, as we'll see in just a minute or two.
And by de novo review, for some, we got some young lawyers that might not have taken Tom's course and know what that means. What does that mean, de novo review?
I know it's Latin.
Okay.
It is an entire review of the case with
anew
yeah, without being bound by the bankruptcy court's decision. So the district court actually examined the record and made a completely new decision, not based on the bankruptcy court's prior determination. The defendant appealed and for the first time raised the Stern versus Marshall issue, claiming that the bankruptcy court lacked jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction to hear the matter because it was a state law centered claim. On appeal, the Ninth Circuit affirmed the district court and made two rulings. The first was that the parties could consent, the defendant in this case, could consent to the jurisdiction of the bankruptcy court and did so impliedly, and also concluded that because of Stern, there was a statutory gap whereby the bankruptcy court had the power to issue final orders in core decisions, had the power to issue findings of fact and conclusions of law in non-core decisions, but the statute obviously had a hole in it because for those core decisions which were unconstitutional, there was no guidance. And the Ninth Circuit said, that's a lesser included decision, and the bankruptcy court certainly has the power to issue that. On appeal to the Supreme Court, the issues were framed as the first one, can the bankruptcy court issue findings of fact and conclusions of law in a core but unconstitutional proceeding, and pitted the executive benefits decision against Ortiz versus Aurora Health coming out of the Seventh Circuit, where the Seventh Circuit said the gap is important, the bankruptcy court has no power to issue findings of fact and conclusions of law in a core but unconstitutional decision.
Has no power because Congress has expressly not a constitutional
correct
decision.
Correct. The statute is silent, therefore there's a gap. The second issue was, can a bankruptcy court enter a final order in a proceeding in which the defendant impliedly consents to the bankruptcy court's jurisdiction? And all of the commentators were really waiting for this second question. This was really one that, if you read the literature leading up to the decision, this was the one they were waiting for. And that pitted executive benefits in the Ninth Circuit, which said, yes, you can, against Waldman versus Stone out of the Sixth, which said, no, you can't. Nobody can consent to give Article III jurisdiction to a non-Article III court. And that decision was also the decision of the Fifth Circuit in Frazin versus Haynes and Boone. Well, the Supreme Court started a unanimous opinion authored by Justice Thomas, which started out by talking about Northern Pipeline, and then talked about the Federal Judgeship Act of 1984, and Stern, and went through the Stern analysis of core proceedings being enacted by Congress, but being determined in Stern that certain of them, unidentified except for the one in the Stern case, as being not within the purview of the bankruptcy court to issue a final order, and indicated that the non-core provisions or portions of the bankruptcy code, the bankruptcy court had the authority to issue findings of fact and conclusions of law, which could be presented to the district court on appeal. The court then went into the statutory gap and said, admittedly, the statute isn't covering all of those particular circumstances, particularly the core but unconstitutional decision, and cited Ortiz as indicating that the court didn't have the power to issue findings of fact and conclusions of law. But Justice Thomas quickly dismissed that, according to the severability clause of the Federal Judgeship Act of 1984, and said where what portion of the act is invalid, it doesn't affect the ability of the court to determine matters under the other portions of the act. And the justice said, you know, unless the statutory text or other evidence indicates Congress preferred no statute at all, then we conclude that the court does have the power to issue findings of fact and conclusions of law in core but unconstitutional decisions or unconstitutional matters. And it fits within the purview of what Congress intended. Then the justice said the district court did a de novo review, and although the district court didn't relabel the matter as a Stern claim, that is core but unconstitutional, it didn't relabel the bankruptcy court's judgment as proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law, because the court did a de novo review, that was all the defendant was entitled to, and upheld the Ninth Circuit decision. What was interesting is the consent issue, which was everybody was, you know, holding their breath waiting for, wasn't really discussed. The court didn't go into the Waldman rationale or the executive benefits rationale, and basically left that for a case Tom's going to talk about in a few minutes, hopefully, the wellness case. The other thing the court didn't decide was that fraudulent transfer actions are core but unconstitutional. The court said the Ninth Circuit determined that, and we're going to assume that that's the case, but we're not going to decide that. And so they left that issue open as well. With that?
Yeah, this was a year of, you know, lawyers and judges and the lower courts struggling over these bankruptcy issues, but Supreme Court decided all four of them that it decided this year unanimously, so not hard for them to bet. Case I want to talk about next is Law versus Siegel. You remember we talked about this last year as one that was coming up. This is the consummate bad actor debtor. Here in this case, Chapter 7, filing in California, where else, the debtor listing his schedules, a home that he valued at $363,000 as his sole asset. It turned out to be worth something in excess of $600,000 when it was sold. Encumbered by about $300,000 in a first mortgage to a bank and a second mortgage to something called Lynn's Mortgage and Associates. He also claimed a $75,000 homestead exemption under California law, and the trustee didn't object to that. But during the case, the trustee investigated the validity of the second mortgage, perhaps thinking that was the only way to get any money out of this for the estate. As they say, as it turned out, there was more there. But there were years of litigation going on in the bankruptcy court, the bankruptcy appellate panel of the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit itself, and litigation to set aside the second mortgage as fraudulent. And ultimately, the estate spent nearly $500,000 in administrative expenses on that fight with the debtor. Ultimately, the bankruptcy court determined that the debtor had perjured himself at least twice in the course of those proceedings. Before he filed his petition, the note and mortgage to Lily Lynn of California, somebody he knew, had asked her to hold the money realized from the mortgage for him. She refused to sign the documents, but the mortgage was nonetheless recorded. Thereafter, the county got a letter indicating, I guess it's foreclosure by not judicial proceeding, but by sale, that Ms. Lynn wished to commence a foreclosure action. She later said she didn't send the letter. It's pretty clearly this was all being done by the debtor. Later, the debtor presented her with a packet of documents which purported to transfer the note and mortgage to his brother. But she refused to sign those too. The debtor filed a motion to compel the trustee to pay out the exempt amount. The trustee filed a motion to surcharge the debtor's exempt property. And he came up with another Lily Lynn who lived in China. He said she'd never been to the United States, but she had a lawyer. And the debtor said this was really the one who held the mortgage. And anyway, the court found that to all be perjured too. Ultimately, the bankruptcy court granted the debtor the trustee's motion to surcharge the proceeds of the sale of the property, but the bankruptcy appellate panel initially reversed that to have the bankruptcy court determine what the true facts were about Lily Lynn of China, as opposed to Lily Lynn of Riverside or wherever she was from. And the bankruptcy court again granted the motion for surcharge. This time the BAP affirmed, and the Ninth Circuit affirmed in an unpublished opinion. You know where this is headed, the Supreme Court from the Ninth Circuit, so you know they're not going to win. Anyway, the debtor got leave to proceed in form of offers, filed a petition for certiorari, and as Pete notes in the outline, trustee in responding to the petition correctly observed that it was difficult to determine what the petitioner wanted the Supreme Court to review. And it was a pretty bad petition, but, you know, again, it was a Ninth Circuit, and it was imposing a surcharge on the exempt property, the exempt assets of the estate. So the question presented to the Supreme Court is, using its equitable powers, may a bankruptcy court surcharge a debtor's exemptions to which timely objections were not made? Justice Scalia, this time, also writing for a unanimous court, pointed out, first of all, that Section 105 gives a bankruptcy court a lot of authority to issue orders necessary or appropriate to carry out the provisions of the Bankruptcy Code, and that bankruptcy courts, under the Marama case, about 8 years ago, has the inherent power to sanction abusive litigation processes. So it isn't that the court lacks power. The question is, what does it have power to do? And the holding of the case is that Section 105 doesn't allow the bankruptcy court to override explicit mandates of other sections of the code. So to the extent that it has power necessary and appropriate to carry out the provisions of the code, it doesn't have the power to carry out actions that are contrary to provisions of the code. Both the trustee and the United States Solicitor General on the trustee's side had argued that the debtor doesn't have the absolute right to retain exempt property, and that 522 doesn't limit the bankruptcy court's authority to impose a surcharge. But the court said, in fact, that it does. Section 522 sets out carefully calibrated exceptions and limitations to the exemptions, and that's it. Of course, the trustee had not timely objected under 522L. That turned out to be a fatal mistake on the trustee's part. Court went on to say that in the past, where lower courts have disallowed exemptions for misconduct, they've done so under circumstances where the exemptions were state-created, based on state law. So the state law might allow that. But the exemption claimed here was one under federal law, which provides that a bankruptcy court may not disallow an exemption on a ground not specified in the code. Court went on, small comfort to the trustee, who was out $500,000 in fees, to say that there are other remedies available to the bankruptcy court for bad acting debtors, including denying discharge under 727, imposing sanctions, including reimbursement of legal fees and expenses under Bankruptcy Rule 9011, and referring it to the U.S. Attorney for Criminal Prosecution, and that there are other sanctioning powers under 105A, and pointed out that if the misconduct occurs post-petition, there can be monetary sanctions imposed to survive the discharge and can be enforced through the normal procedures for collecting money judgments. But at the end, reversed and remanded, no surcharge permitted under even these bad circumstances.
Well, Tom, what good would it have done the trustee to object to the exemption? That would have been like 30 days into the case.
Yeah.
And the fees were not incurred
yeah.
at that time. And what would have been the grounds anyway, even if the trustee had known?
I don't know. You know, it's a very short time to object to exemptions. What was the case 7 or 8 years ago where the same issue arose with the trustee forgetting or not objecting to the exemption?
Well, not having grounds then.
No. Right.
And even if the time were extended, for example, if the trustee knew that this was a really bad actor and you know, had some knowledge that there was an illegal mortgage out there, and so the trustee objects. Why?
Yeah.
I mean, what are the grounds that there's an illegal mortgage?
It's like the solace that the court gives at the end of the opinion about all the other things the court has the power to do. None of them are going to help in these circumstances.
Well, it might if the trustee got a money judgment, and could he garnish himself for the $75,000 that he's supposed to pay the debtor, or
give it to him and then garnish it, and then
yeah, and then execute on the $75,000. I mean, unless he turns it into cash and puts it under the mattress. If it goes into a bank, maybe there could be something. But there are circumstances in which a trustee can be garnished. You see that with Chapter 13 trustees from time to time. So
the officer's wrinkling his nose over there as if he
disagrees with me.
Well, maybe. I recognize the judge. I don't have any answers. I see Mr. Campbell's there out here. Send him to the U.S. Attorney. Go put him in prison. That would give you some moral satisfaction.
Right. Well, send the sheriff to execute on the mattress.
You can also form the process on the
Mr. Farbinger.
Yeah.
I see some of the table.
I love Farbinger as long as it's for the benefit of the party that's really been injured, not the United States.
Well, the trustee is the one injured if he's not getting his fees.
I agree.
United States was injured. The United States was injured.
Yeah, I didn't probably pay taxes, is that what you're saying?
Probably.
Yeah. Anytime the law is broken, the United States is injured.
You want to talk about this tax case hiding under the guise of a bankruptcy?
Yeah, speaking of taxes, United States versus Quality Stores is exactly that. It's really a tax case wrapped in a bankruptcy proceeding. Quality Stores was one of the nation's largest agricultural specialty retailers. It closed its doors, terminating all of its employees and paying them severance payments under a pre-petition severance plan. Basically, stay bonuses, not uncommon in many cases, to induce employees to stay through the conclusion of the case, even a liquidation proceeding, in order to maximize value. The government took the position that the payments constituted wages under the Federal Insurance Compensation Act, FICA, and the debtor paid the taxes but protested and actually filed an action in bankruptcy court to determine that the payments were not subject to FICA tax, claiming it was due a refund. The bankruptcy court agreed with the debtor's position and indicated it was entitled to a refund of over $1 million. The district court agreed with the bankruptcy court, and the Sixth Circuit affirmed, saying that it was not, these payments were not FICA wages subject to taxation. The issue on appeal was whether severance payments made to the employees whose employment was involuntarily terminated were taxable under FICA. Justice Kennedy, right before the court, began by indicating that the definition of wages is extremely broad. It is basically any cash remuneration paid for any services, and that under this definition, these severance payments would constitute remuneration for employment. He also pointed out that FICA exempts from taxation wages paid for severance payments in connection with retirement, but other than that, there are other specific exemptions, not including the exemptions in this particular case. However, Quality Stores pointed to the Internal Revenue Code, whereby under Section 3402, it indicated that supplemental unemployment benefits were to be treated as if they were payments of wages. And in fact, in the section heading under that section, in boldface, it is treatment of payments, not wages. And they pointed to that section heading and said, Judge, these aren't wages. Justice Kennedy indicated that like FICA, the Internal Revenue Code has specific exemptions and severance payments were not included among those exemptions. The court then went into the history of these types of payments, and reaching back to the 1950s and 60s, indicated that there was a conflict with state unemployment compensation, which was conditioned on no other wages being paid. And so Congress determined that severance payments were not wages for that purpose to allow the state payments to be made. Nonetheless, they were still subject to taxation, and because there was no withholding, the employees who received these payments had a big tax bill at the end of the year. So Congress, trying to remedy that, determined that they should be treated as if they're wages for withholding purposes, so that the payments would be subject to withholding as they were made. However, the court determined that notwithstanding the fact that this was an accommodation to the employees, there, based on the legislative history, court didn't determine, or determined that Congress did not intend that these payments were exempt from taxation as wages under FICA, and reversed and remanded the proceeding.
To the bankruptcy court?
Back to the, I'm not sure.
Is this a court proceeding?
They're probably, that's an interesting question. I thought about that.
Did anybody raise the jurisdictional issue?
Nobody raised the jurisdictional issue, and the court didn't address.
Okay.
The last case the court decided in bankruptcy this year was Clark versus Ramaker, which Pete has referred to in our notes as the Ramaker case. I mean, other than the fact that we know Bill, it's probably the Clark case.
Probably. Yeah.
the debtor, we hope, won't be a repeat user of the court system as much as the trustee.
No.
This is a case out of the Western District in which there was a joint Chapter 7 husband and wife filing. The wife inherited a $300,000 IRA from her mother, and she claimed the funds exempt under 522D12 make sure I get the statutory language, retirement funds exempt to the extent that those funds are in a fund or account that is exempt from taxation under various sections of the Internal Revenue Code. In the wife's hands, under the Internal Revenue Code, these funds retained their tax-exempt status, but they were subject to, as an inherited IRA, they were subject to required distribution 1 year after the receipt of the funds, and they couldn't be rolled over into the wife's IRA. Well, by the time the case came to bankruptcy, the wife had spent much of the $300,000, but apparently there was enough there to argue about. She claimed it exempt. Ramaker objected to the exemption. Judge Martin denied the exemption, finding that the funds in the inherited IRA didn't constitute retirement funds in the hands of the debtor. Now it left the specialty court and went to the district court, where Judge Crabb, looking at a bunch of cases from around the country, decided that the question was close, and the close question should be decided in the debtor's favor. It relied on a lot of bankruptcy court decisions, which of course didn't endear her decision to Judge Easterbrook when it got to the Seventh Circuit. Judge Easterbrook was on the panel, wrote the opinion of the Seventh Circuit, and reversed Judge Crabb, basically in favor of Judge Martin's reasoning. He concluded that the exemption applied to the nature of the funds in the hands of the debtor, not whether the funds had been retirement funds at one time. The Seventh Circuit said that to be exempt, the funds had to be, to be bankruptcy exempt, the funds had to be both tax exempt and retirement funds, so the language of D-12. So retention of the tax attributes alone is not enough. So the issue presented to the Supreme Court is whether inherited IRAs are exempt retirement funds under 522D12. And the Supreme Court, again, unanimous opinion, this time by Justice Sotomayor, started out by pointing out that there's no definition of retirement funds in the code. It must be one of the few things not defined in the bankruptcy code. But that the plain meaning of it is sums of money set aside for the day when the debtor stops working. She pointed out that inherited IRAs have three attributes that differ from ordinary Roth or non-Roth traditional IRAs that one might have. First of all, you can't put more money into them. Secondly, the holders are required to withdraw the funds from the account, no matter how far away from retirement the inheriting party may be. Mrs. Clark was not very old. She wasn't on the eve of retirement. And finally, the holder may withdraw the entire balance at any time without penalty. So the court held that allowing debtors to protect funds in traditional and Roth IRAs is consistent with the code's purpose of protecting a debtor's essential needs to enable a fresh start. But funds in inherited IRAs don't protect the debtor's need for retirement. My God, you could even spend them on a car, a sports car even, or a vacation home, as Justice Sotomayor pointed out. So they're not essential to the fresh start in the way that true retirement funds would be.
So the court rejected the petitioner's argument that as long as the original owner had the funds deposited in a traditional or Roth IRA, the exemption shouldn't apply. I should point out here that one of the things that I think we talked about last year when we talked about this as a coming case that was interesting was that both Judge Martin and Judge Easterbrook had approached this from a sort of a let's get real point of view. These aren't retirement funds in the hands of the debtor, even if they had been retirement funds in the hands of her mother. And the concern that those who got their hands on this case had was that that might not appeal to a textualist Supreme Court. So they recast the argument in the brief in the Supreme Court more in strict textual terms and essentially ignored the ground on which the Seventh Circuit and the Bankruptcy Court had decided the case. And interestingly, the Supreme Court went right to what the Seventh Circuit had done and decided it on that basis. In other words, it didn't spend a lot of time fussing over the language of the bankruptcy code. It went to what it thought to be really the what the bankruptcy code was all about. To be exempt, the court said the funds had to be both exempt from taxation and be retirement funds, the language I read from D-12, whatever that is. To allow anything that was once an exempt IRA in somebody else's hands to be withdrawn and reinvested for any purpose would read the requirement that they be retirement funds out of the statute. The court also dismissed the debtor's argument that because 522B3C, the definition of a retirement fund, not a retirement fund, but the exemption of property for this purpose, didn't include this was an interesting argument. This was sort of the textualist argument that the trustee side was worried about. Most of the definitions in 522, I think all of them except this, 522B, exempted the debtor's interest in whatever, the debtor's interest in. This one didn't have that language, and the argument was made that it was to distinguish between the debtor's and somebody else's interest in, and the court says, Justice Sotomayor said no, it was just to set a limit on the value of a particular asset that the debtor may exempt, not to somehow separate out funds that had been retirement funds of somebody other than a debtor.
Well, Tom,
yeah.
Judge Martin decided another case years ago in another context, but it may make a difference. Nobody raised it in this case. I mean, even the Supreme Court called it an inherited IRA, which it's not. It's the debtor was beneficiary designation.
Right.
And that's not...
But it's inherited in the sense that somebody had to die.
Somebody died, right. But
one didn't pass by will or intestate succession.
And that's what the definition of an inheritance is.
Right.
But sloppy language aside, Judge Martin had a case where the debtor had a POD account, or was the beneficiary of a POD account, payable on death.
Yeah.
And it had to do with whether it was property of the estate because it was within 6 months. And Judge Martin said, no, because it's not inherited, it's a beneficiary designation, so it was not property of the estate. And so it could, if anybody bothered to raise it and look at the definition of inheritance, might see that if somebody was the beneficiary of an IRA during that 6 months before filing, it's not an inherited asset. So calling it inherited may end up with some money being sucked into the bankruptcy estate that really shouldn't be if you went back to the definition. It probably didn't matter in this case, but it's not inherited, it's a beneficiary designation.
Well, and finally, in response to the debtor's suggestion that inherited IRAs could still be held for the debtor's retirement, Justice Sotomayor said, well, so could your checking account, so could an envelope full, mm-hmm. Full of $20 bills. You could hold them as retirement funds, intending to use them that way, but that doesn't make them retirement funds. They're not, in fact, held for retirement. So, debtor loses. Ramaker wins.
Yes.
That ends last term's decisions, and as Judge Kelly pointed out, we have three issues, four cases actually. They granted on two yesterday, but they're identical, so they'll be treated as a single case. Two issues that we knew about and were able to write up about, and the one that came down yesterday that I'll tell you about at the end, that is, but it didn't come down yesterday. The Supreme Court granted cert yesterday. We'll talk about that in a minute. The first of the cases comes from the Seventh Circuit, and again, it's part of the Stern family. Post-Stern, what the hell have we got sitting?
I don't know that anybody wants to be part of the Stern family.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's right.
You used to think you would want to be part of the Marshall family, but they're all dead too.
So. Yeah. I say there was a lady who wanted to be part of the Marshall family pretty badly. She actually wasn't married to him for very long. Then everybody started interfering with her inheritance, and that's where, you know, a real inheritance, right?
Yeah.
interfering with her testamentary expectations. This case out of the Seventh Circuit began in Texas. If you can't be in California, be in Texas if you want interesting facts, speaking of the Marshall case, which was in Texas and California.
Mm-hmm.
So, where the craziness of this nation resides on the left and the right. Mr. Sharif was a distributor of health and wellness products for Wellness International Network Limited, and apparently had a falling out with his grantor or whatever they were, and sued them in Texas in the district court, alleging that Wellness was running a pyramid scheme. Probably it was, but he was part of it. So litigation gets started, and as we sometimes see happen, Mr. Sharif, having started the lawsuit, decided he didn't like all the incidents of being involved in litigation, like making discovery. And we'll come across why he might not have wanted to make discovery a little bit farther along in the case. He ignored many discovery requests from Wellness, and that led ultimately to many material facts being deemed admitted, and that led to the district court in Texas entering summary judgment in favor of Wellness. Sharif appealed, Fifth Circuit affirmed, and it ended up with a $655,000 judgment being entered against Sharif. Wellness tried to collect that judgment in Texas. He ignored the discovery requests post-judgment, ended up getting arrested for civil contempt and how to do it in Texas. Court entered an order to compel, ordered sanctions, and he again ignored the district court's order because he had a way out. He filed a Chapter 7 petition in the Northern District of Illinois. Welcome to Chicago. At the initial meeting of creditors, the Chapter 7 trustee asked a question that one of you as a trustee might have asked. Well, what about this loan application from 7 years ago when you borrowed, applied to borrow some money from WAMU, and you said you had assets of $5 million. What happened to that $5 million? And at the continued 341 meeting, Sharif admitted that he lied on the application, that being convenient at this point, and that the assets were held in a trust of which he was the trustee. So, you know, not available to pay his creditors, clearly. Wellness files an adversary proceeding, we're now in Chicago, seeking a denial of discharge under 727 and a declaratory judgment that the trust was his alter ego and should be, its content should be property of the estate. Guess what? He again refuses to comply with discovery requests. The bankruptcy court grants a motion to compel and said that if he didn't comply, there would be a default judgment entered against him in the adversary proceeding and in the discharge question. He provided some documents, but not enough. Ultimately, the bankruptcy judge determined that he had violated the discovery orders more than 15 times, entered a default judgment in both the case and the adversary proceeding, as well as awarding Wellness over $60,000 in fees and costs. Mr. Sharif appealed to the district court, didn't raise any Stern issues. However, in December of 2011, His sister filed a motion to withdraw the reference based upon Stern. I haven't quite figured out how that works. Maybe she was a beneficiary of the trust. I don't know. I've forgotten. I didn't know. The district court, assuming for purposes of the decision that the sister had standing, denied the motion to withdraw the reference, first of all, because it was way too late. Secondly, because the court said the issue had been waived, and affirmed the judgment of the bankruptcy court applying a deferential standard of review. Sharif appealed to the Seventh Circuit. The Seventh Circuit framed the issues as two, whether the bankruptcy court had the authority to enter a final judgment on the denial of discharge and alter ego claims, and secondly, whether that's an issue that can be waived. The court ruled that the counts of the wellness complaint dealing with denial of discharge were core matters, I think quite clearly they were, and that the bankruptcy court had the authority to issue a final judgment. Again, I think not much question about that. But then the court said that the alter ego claim relating to the trust, are the assets of the trust property of the estate, is not listed among the core claims in Section 157, but of course that list isn't exclusive. So he argued, Sharif argued, that the count dealing with the trust and the alter ego claim was non-core. The bankruptcy court lacked constitutional authority to enter judgment on that claim. The Seventh Circuit said that he had waived the issue, but it continued to discuss extensively the constitutional authority of the bankruptcy court and to discuss Stern. Regarding waiver, the court acknowledged that there was a circuit split with the Ninth Circuit ruling in Bellingham, which had not yet been decided. What do we call it now? Do we want to call it Bellingham?
Executive benefits.
Executive benefits had not yet been decided. And between the Ninth Circuit and the Sixth Circuit, which had ruled that the objection to the power of the bankruptcy judge under Article 3 cannot be waived. Seventh Circuit said that nothing in Stern suggested that a party can waive an Article 3 objection, so agreeing with the Sixth Circuit held that a party may consent to a final disposition of a non-core matter by the bankruptcy court, but may not do so with respect to a core but unconstitutional proceeding covered by Stern. The court said that if the claim was a core claim because it was based on Illinois state law, but nevertheless the claim didn't involve public rights and was a state law claim involving private rights, and therefore the court lacked the constitutional authority to enter final judgment. If the alter ego claim was core, the court said, relying on Ortiz, discussed a few minutes ago, the statutory gap problem prevented the bankruptcy court from proposing findings and conclusions. And then the court went on to bloviate a bit about the difference between bankruptcy judges and magistrate judges and what one could do and what the other could do. What they have in common is they're not Article III judges. So the court reversed and remanded to the district court to determine whether the alter ego claim was core or non-core. That led to the petition for certiorari. And wellness framed the issues being whether a state court, state law property issue in an action to determine property of the estate under Section 541 of the Code in the possession of the debtor means that the action does not stem from the bankruptcy itself, precluding the bankruptcy court from having constitutional authority to enter a final order deciding the issue. Secondly, whether Article 3 permits a bankruptcy court to exercise the judicial power of the United States, which is ultimately what Stern is about, over claims against a debtor who has consented to the exercise of judicial power by filing a voluntary petition. And thirdly, whether Article 3 permits the bankruptcy court to exercise the judicial power of the United States on the basis of litigant consent, and whether consent based upon a litigant's conduct is sufficient to satisfy Article 3. Wellness argued that the Seventh Circuit has expanded Stern to provide that a bankruptcy court doesn't have the authority to decide issues between a trustee and a debtor over what property belongs to the estate, that this runs counter to the observation of the Chief Justice in the Stern decision that the case doesn't change all that much. Well, we'll see. pointed out a number of conflicts between the Seventh Circuit's decision, in Wellness's view anyway, and decisions of other courts of appeals, including that whether property belonged to the bankruptcy estate was inextricably tied to the question of who was entitled to the property, both of them intimately tied to the traditional bankruptcy functions and to defining the estate itself, contrary to decision of the Fourth Circuit. Wellness also argued that the Seventh Circuit's conclusion that a 541 claim is a state law claim also conflicts with Sixth Circuit's, which have held that actions under 541 are federal law claims, even though they always, as you might imagine, always raise state law issues. What is property is an issue of state law usually. And finally, regarding consent, Stern dealt only with the question of consent given by a party other than a debtor. Here, Sharif both expressly consented to the bankruptcy court's adjudication by filing and impliedly consented by conduct. You may want to read, because we don't have enough time to go into it, some of the arguments have been raised in the amicus briefs. It's obviously an issue that's drawn a lot of attention. I always look at the Solicitor General's brief. It does better than others. And you'll see on page 14 of the outline, I think a couple of interesting points are the ones under B and D. The Seventh Circuit's affirming the denial of discharge for concealing property of the estate is premised on a determination that the assets were property of the estate, and that duplicates the premises of the alter ego claim. In other words, you know, it clearly had authority to decide the discharge. The denial of discharge under 727, and it's really the same issue. And then D, the government argues that a right to a final adjudication by an Article III judge is a waivable personal interest. I'm sure that's right. We'll see. You know, the argument being that no, it's rather a structural interest. It protects our liberty. But we won't be free anymore if bankruptcy judges can decide these issues. That certainly makes sense to me.
It almost seems like the consent issue is subsidiary. I mean, if the court rules that any state law issue involving property of the estate is something the bankruptcy court can't determine.
Right.
I mean, as a number of the amicus briefs point out, that runs throughout the code. That could be a real game changer.
I don't think the court's going to do that myself, but I think they might well duck consent again.
you may be right. The second case that the Supreme Court's taking up is on legal fees.
Listen up.
And in the Baker Botts versus Asarco LLC. Interesting case. Baker Botts and its co-counsel represented Asarco, a copper mining, smelting, refining company that had tax, environmental, toxic tort, and cash flow issues that precipitated a Chapter 11 filing in 2005. 2 years before the bankruptcy, the debtor's parent, American Mining Corporation, directed the debtor to sell its most valuable asset, the Southern Copper Corporation, to it,
probably a fair price.
At probably a bargain price. During the Chapter 11, Baker Botts successfully prosecuted a fraudulent transfer claim against the parent, who was still the shareholder of the debtor, resulting in a judgment of between $7 and $10 billion, which was reported to be the largest unreversed actual damage award in history.
Wow.
Based on the award, the debtor reorganized, solved all of its financial problems, and paid all of its creditors $3.56 billion, paying them in full.
And the lawyers wanted a piece of that?
Lawyers asked for both their fees and a fee enhancement of the core fees. The parent, who is now in control of the reorganized debtor, objected to both the base fees and the requested fee enhancement, and in the course of that dispute, compelled Baker Botts to produce every document that it sent or it received during the 52-month bankruptcy, constituting 6 million pages. After a six-day trial, the bankruptcy court awarded Baker Botts its core fees, a $4.1 million enhancement, and $5 million of defense costs for successfully defending its fee application, concluding that the defense cost was necessary to the administration of the case, beneficial to the estate, and necessary to avoid dilution of Baker Botts' core fees.
The did everything but kissed him on both cheeks and
absolutely. The U.S. trustee did not object to any of the requested fees or fee enhancements. The parent appealed, and at this juncture only appealed the fee enhancement and the fee defense award. The district court affirmed both fee awards, calling the Chapter 11 the most successful in history of the code. And the parent appealed.
It's a good case if you want to have a good decision for bankruptcy fees. Okay. The most successful in the history of the world.
Yep.
It is a short timeline.
The Fifth Circuit took it up, and
Judge Edith Jones, right?
And she quickly affirmed the fee enhancement award, saying that was reasonable. Where she took issue with her brethren below was on the defense award. And she said that Section 330A4A2 requires that to be allowable, the fees must either benefit the estate or be necessary to case administration. And then relying on an 11th Circuit case, Grant versus George Schumann, which she said was similar, factually similar to this case, concluded that the fee defense awards were not appropriate. That Section 330A6 specifically allows fees to be charged for the application preparation, but is silent as to defense. She noted that the Ninth Circuit in In Re Smith had found that defense costs were compensable as a necessary cost of case administration, but concluded that Grant, the 11th Circuit case, was closer to the plain meaning of the code, and denied the free defense costs. She also indicated that although Baker Botts argued that the fee award for defense was similar to federal fee shifting, that it really was different. Bankruptcy cases are different than other federal cases in that, according to Grant, everybody loses. And the cost of defending a fee application is the cost of doing business. Nor was she persuaded by the argument that disallowing fees for defense unduly and unfairly dilutes the bankruptcy court's core fees, making them not equivalent to fees in other practice areas as Congress intended. She also said, gee, if I disallow the $5 million fee defense award, that's only 4.6 of the total fees involved in the case. That's not really all that much, and making that comparable to fees and other disciplines of the law is really in the eye of the beholder. And because the American rule is each party pays their own defense costs, and because the statute can't be, in her opinion, be read to include defense costs as either beneficial to the estate or necessary to case administration, she denied them. Baker Botts petitioned for cert, and in their petition noted the circuit split between the Smith case in the Ninth Circuit and the Grant case in the 11th Circuit, and pointed out that Grant wasn't factually similar at all. In Grant, the court slammed the trustee, didn't award his core fees, and complained that the parties really hadn't done their job. Whereas this was the most successful case in the history of the bankruptcy code. Baker Botts said that of all the cases in the country that had decided this issue, all of them had said it's a matter of discretion. It's not statutorily prohibited, it's a matter of discretion, even those cases that didn't award defense costs. They pointed out that you can't close a case without resolving a fee dispute. fee application.
Makes it necessary to the administration of the estate.
Necessary to the administration of the case.
Bit of a stretch.
And that the costs of, or the nature of preparing a fee application and defending it are really indistinguishable. That where Congress entitled somebody to be paid for preparing the application, subsumed in that is paying them to defend it if it's objected to. They also pointed out that it is a substantial dilution of the core fees and making practice in the bankruptcy area different than practice in other disciplines, contrary to Congress's intent. And although it was only 4.4% here, could be much bigger, a much larger reduction in a much smaller case. Again, we're not going to spend much time on the amicus briefs. A couple of bar associations have supported.
Come out in favor of fees for lawyers.
I don't think the briefing was concluded at the time we wrote the article. But it'll be interesting to see what the court does.
Well, I got a couple of minutes. Let me talk a bit about the case that the Supreme Court granted cert on yesterday. Bank of America versus Calkett, C-A-U-L-K-E-T-T. I don't know which one. I granted actually in both Calkett and one called Toledo Cardona. Both of them from the 11th Circuit, both of them having to do with lien stripping under 506B. A situation we may all thought of as having been resolved in Doosnip versus Tim 22 years ago by the Supreme Court. The situation is, you know, typically, and a lot of them arise now, obviously, in which there is both a first and a second mortgage on residential real estate. The first mortgage is completely underwater. The second mortgage appears to be also. The debtor files for Chapter 7, this is all about Chapter 7, and then goes in and asks under 506B for determination of secured status and asks the bankruptcy court to determine that to the extent that a lien secures a claim against the debtor that is not an allowed secured claim, such lien is void. Get rid of the second lien too. The bank that has a second mortgage recognizes that it can't collect now, recognizes that the debtor has been discharged from personal liability. So this is basically just a naked lien sitting there on property, but wants to hold on to it, sometimes because the debtor continues to live in the house and pay the mortgage, but ultimately because the bank, like all of us, hoping that the value of property will go up and sometime that lien will reawaken and be worth something. That's how the issue is presented. The version of that was in Doosnip in 1992. But prior to Doosnip, the 11th Circuit had decided a case allowing fee stripping under these circumstances. And when the issue was revisited in the current economic conditions back in 2012, the 11th Circuit panel came to the conclusion that really Doosnip did not preclude stripping off both liens. The Bank of America, I think in most of these cases, sought certiorari, and at the same time there was a petition for rehearing in bank pending in the 11th Circuit. The Supreme Court denied certiorari last March in that case. The 11th Circuit declined to rehear the case en banc in May. Within days, the two cases that cert was granted on yesterday were affirmed based on the 2012 decision in the 11th Circuit. The 11th Circuit following its own precedent. You know, each of the opinions in the 11th Circuit on which cert was granted is, you know, half a page long. We're following our opinion. The decision is directly contrary to opinions elsewhere in the country, the 4th, the 6th, and the 7th Circuit. Judge Posner wrote an opinion in the Palomar case a year or so ago in which he explained that Section 506D is best interpreted as confirming the venerable principle the bankruptcy law permits a lien to pass through bankruptcy unaffected
provided that it's a valid lien and secures a valid claim. It concluded that Doosnip defeated the debtor's attempt to strip off the creditor's wholly underwater lien. Doosnip, Judge Posner says, holds that Section 506D does not allow the bankruptcy court to squeeze down a fully valid lien to the current value of the property to which it's attached. That's the relief the debtor in this case is seeking. The only difference between this case and Doosnip is that our debtors want to reduce the value of the lien to zero, a difference that is immaterial in light of Doosnip's reading. My guess is they've taken it up to reverse, but that's the other case, bankruptcy case, out of this term. So far.
So far, yeah. You might have more. Come back next November. No, come back in December, actually, for Ethics by Mark Matz and Olivia Ryer. That's on December 9th. We'll have cookies. And come back in January for Judge McGarity's discussion of credit reports. Thank you very much for coming. Thanks again, Keith and Tom. Really great.